It's obtuse logic that valuable woodpecker deer habitat should be liquidated.
A plan to make a southeast stream more friendly to salmon is drawing both praise and criticism. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, January 2nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a home remodel in Kodiak uncovers a note from the past hidden inside the walls.
She said, oh, won't that be grand someday when new people in the house read this?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If subsistence is important to you, consider applying for a seat on your local federal subsistence regional advisory council. The councils provide information and recommendations to the Federal Subsistence Board on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing. Deadline to apply is Friday, February 3rd. Call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov for more information. This message sponsored by your Federal Subsistence Board and the U.S. Departments of the Interior and Agriculture.
Police say a 21-year-old woman was killed after she was hit by a car in Fairbanks just a few hours after she had been released from the city jail yesterday morning. Police say Michaela R. Keitlinger was hit by a vehicle about 6:55 a.m. and was pronounced dead shortly after she was taken to Fairbanks Memorial Hospital. In a statement, police say Keitlinger had been arrested about 5 a.m. on Sunday on suspicion of public intoxication. Police do not know exactly when she was released from jail. Police say the driver of the vehicle was on the way to work when the driver came upon Keitlinger, who was wearing dark clothing in the center of Davis Road between Lathrop Street and Wilbur Street. Police say the driver tried to avoid hitting Keitlinger, and a witness directly behind the vehicle backed up that statement. Police say there's no sign the driver was speeding and has not been charged. The U.S. Forest Service is moving forward with a project to restore a stream damaged by decades-old logging and road building south of Petersburg. The work will likely mean logging some other trees on another part of the island, and that's generated some opposition. KFSK's Joe Vicknicki reports.
Omer Creek crosses underneath Mitkoff Highway about 21 miles south of Petersburg. During construction of that roadway in 1959 and 60, trees were cut from about 20 acres around the stream. Crews also removed stumps and dug out sand and gravel from the floodplain of the creek to build the highway. That left part of Omer Creek a wider, shallower stream where heavy rains erode the stream banks and young salmon have no deep pools to grow and survive. Forest Service hydrologist Heath Whitaker says restoration work is planned for Omer Creek and a tributary called Lumpy Creek.
What this project would do would basically be to work within those same areas, add wood to some of those old structures, create new structures, add some cover to the rearing ponds that wasn't there. We want to reestablish the connection between one of the rearing ponds and Lumpy Creek that's only connected at higher water flows.
The streams support populations of three kinds of salmon and two kinds of trout. Adding wood to the stream can stabilize banks and help create deep pools where young salmon can survive a winter freeze or heavy rains in the fall. An environmental analysis for the project states the quality of habitat in the two creeks is declining and will continue to worsen without the restoration work. The practice of cutting trees on fish streams on national forest land ended with the Tongass Timber Reform Act of 1990, which required stream buffers. The Forest Service already did some work on that creek a decade and a half ago, digging out some pools for fish-rearing ponds and placing some wood. Whitaker says that work has made a difference, but more is needed. The agency proposes building 15 large wood structures in the creek using trees with root wads still attached. To build those wood structures, the project will use 110 old-growth trees from National Forest land at Woodpecker Cove, about 12 miles from Omer Creek. Becky Knight is a board member of the Greater Southeast Alaska Conservation Community, which has raised concerns with the project.
It's obtuse logic that valuable woodpecker deer habitat should be liquidated and the old-growth timber that supports that habitat be used to restore Omer Creek. As most people are aware, there's been significant public concern regarding the incremental loss of local deer habitat, but no prior or specific public concern about the need to restore Omer Creek.
Knight notes she doesn't mean to say that Omer Creek isn't degraded, but she thinks the agency would be better off fixing hanging and blocked road culverts that impede fish passage. In comments on the project, the state's Department of Natural Resources recommended taking wood left behind in areas that have already been logged before cutting the trees in Woodpecker. Another state agency, the Department of Environmental Conservation, fully supported the work. The source of the trees isn't set. The agency has agreed to consider other options for the wood. Whitaker says any stream restoration project will require using some wood from somewhere else in the forest.
We've collected wood from old-growth stands, young-growth stands. We've used logs from decommissioned bridges. We've used wood from riparian areas. We've used blowdown patches. We've taken it from highway expansions. We've taken it from road building. Basically, wherever we choose to take the wood, there's usually somebody that thinks we should have chosen somewhere else.
Whitaker notes the old growth trees would be cut next to an area that's already been logged. He says a wildlife specialist looked at the proposal and acknowledged there would be an impact, but it wouldn't be significant. So does it make sense to use deer habitat to fix salmon habitat? Whitaker thinks so.
If you look at the analysis and you look at where we're getting the wood versus the benefits of what we're doing, we're basically taking 2 acres of old growth habitat out of production, old growth POG they call it. But we are benefiting about a half a mile of salmon stream on a large salmon stream, and you know a portion of the 20 acre floodplain. And so I thought it was worthwhile. The decision maker also thought it was worthwhile.
The decision maker in this case is District Ranger David Zimmerman. He signed off on an environmental assessment for the stream work in late November. The project probably won't start for a couple of years. The agency hopes to do the work at the same time a timber sale happens in the area, but the project is designed to happen with or without a separate timber harvest. The agency would contract the work out, and it's expected to cost around $150,000. Old logging equipment, 55-gallon drums, and cables would also be removed from the area. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicnicki.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, homeless in Dillingham following one man's decade-long struggle.
And everybody goes through different things in lifestyle. We don't know what's hold for each person.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Understanding the long-term impacts of child and family trauma is the life work of Dr. Linda Chamberlain. Dr. Chamberlain is the director of the Alaska Family Violence Prevention Project. She says more than 2 decades ago, the focus was on physical injury. But she says the far greater impacts of violence are the unseen traumas that affect children, whether they directly witness violence or not.
Because of how the brain develops, the younger the child, the more vulnerable. So actually, we see PTSD in infants. We see very significant consequences for young children. So something I said in the early days, too young to know, I would never say now, because in fact it's quite the opposite. You are rarely just working with domestic violence. You have co-occurring substance abuse. Due to the impact of domestic violence, there's depression in the household. There's likely to be an incarcerated parent. So you realize you're not dealing with one adversity. So we're not just a domestic violence project. We look now at the whole family in terms of the implications, and we understand that we're dealing with polyvictimization or multiple traumas.
When you're talking about ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, children experiencing violence directly or witnessing it, What are some of the long-term implications of this trauma for children?
The brain always prioritizes survival first. When an infant or a child does not feel physically and emotionally safe, people tend to focus on the physical, and neglect is one of the worst, you know, forms of maltreatment. The ability for the child to be in that upper learning thinking area of the brain, so it compromises learning in a huge way. But there's physical, very predictable physical health consequences. Asthma is a big one. Gastrointestinal problems. When the brain prioritizes survival, it's going to suppress the immune system. So these children get sick with things that other kids don't get as easily. They stay sick longer. Behavioral problems, it's usually a mix, but it ranges from what we call externalizing problems, like, aggression, acting out, to internalizing, withdrawal, socially isolating. So we'll see, you know, different mental health diagnoses that may actually be reflective of the fact that so many kids have post-traumatic stress disorder.
Dr. Chamberlain, can severe trauma, such as a young child witnessing the murder of family members or being caught in war, can that sort of trauma ever truly be overcome?
Absolutely. So much of it comes back to the brain, the capacity of the brain to adapt and change. It's greatest when we're children. We never lose it. So our ability to heal over our lifetime is extraordinary. We learn more about that each day, but we know more than ever before about how to help children as well as adult survivors to recover. People tease me because I smile when I talk about trauma, and the reason that I smile is because I am acutely aware of the capacity for the brain to change and our ability to heal.
Dr. Chamberlain, the impacts of abuse ripple out beyond the person directly affected, of course. If people don't get help and address their trauma, it may cause them to act out in negative ways in the future. What can and should people do to help others that they know are struggling, that they see neighbors or maybe other family members at a distance, especially children? What's the right approach for compassionate outreach?
The biggest protective factor is relationships. You know, making connections with people in a supportive, you know, non-judgmental and safe way, you know, that builds resiliency in people and in communities. It's not that we are going to resolve what's going on in their life, but what prevents the consequences that I was describing of early trauma, whether we're talking for, you know, children or adults, is when they have good social support. So it's about connecting with a kid, playing a game, board games, playing cards. Those are really good at building the most advanced area of the brain and skills called executive function. Making that phone call to a neighbor, giving them, you know, helping them to the grocery store. Or the irony is the science to help us understand what is happening, why trauma affects us the way it does, can be seen as fairly complex, you know, the brain science and so forth. But what makes a difference in terms of protective factors and building resilience, that's back to the basics. It's back to preserving culture, language. I looked at, you know, all Arctic, you know, 8 Arctic nations when we looked at resiliency for indigenous cultures, self-determination, preserving traditions. Those are huge protective factors, and they are for whatever our culture is. When we build relationships, we're building brains, we're building, you know, healthy kids, intergenerational connection, and we're building healthy communities.
Dr. Linda Chamberlain is the director of the Alaska Family Violence Prevention Project. There's no homeless shelter in Dillingham, but there aren't many who have nowhere to turn to get in from the cold. 61-year-old Matthew McCarr is one of a handful who call the streets home. He's lived this way for more than a decade, And while it's tough, he says, this is part of living life on his own terms. KDLG's Avery Lill has more.
Stand out in the red door.
Matthew McCarr and I are walking through downtown Dillingham. He's checking the trash for a cigarette he can finish, and he teaches me how to say, I'm not doing anything, in Yupik. Once a kindergarten teacher in Sitka, he found his students learned best if they were singing. In Sitka, he had a guitar, but now he has a harmonica that he plays every day, around town or at his camp. McCarr is homeless, one of the few in Dillingham during the winter.
What I learned about that being by myself was sitting there being really patient. And this old man, I got to thank him for giving me harmonica. So that really, really helped my thoughts. And I'm really thankful for that old man that gave me that.
McCarr makes camp in an abandoned shipping container. It offers protection from the elements, but when the temperature drops, it becomes more of an icebox than a shelter. Describing life at his camp, McCarr thinks first of the ways in which it's emotionally and physically taxing.
Cold, wet, things in mind, you think about children, family, and, you know, I don't have radio, I don't have this, the only thing I have is harmonica, so that's, and the Bible, of course, that's the main thing, my Bible.
When his neck is warm, he sleeps better. Sometimes he has to choose between sleeping with his socks on his feet and wearing them like a scarf. Other nights, it's just too cold to sleep.
I would wake up certain hours early in the morning and, you know, just wondering about time because I don't wear a watch, but I'd get up when I start feeling my muscles start jerking or getting cramped, and I'd get up and put my stuff and just walk out and just go through town.
Normally, he can count on one meal a day from the senior center, and sometimes people give him food. Other times, he digs food out of the dumpster. He says if you learn to read food from the garbage, you can avoid getting sick. But health is a concern. About a month ago, McCarr says he had an operation to remove his colon. Now he's on a lot of medication, and it's been hard to keep up his weight. That's important if you're living outdoors and need the insulation and energy. As McCarr reflects on being homeless, the word he uses most often is choice. Choices that he's made in the past and the ones that he's making every day.
And everybody goes through different things in lifestyle. We don't know what's whole for each person. You know, it's their own choosing what they want. See, this was my own choosing what I wanted.
It's a choice McCarr has been making for about 14 years.
It's something that stayed in me for a long time. It's been eating me inside, which I never talk about for a long time. So that's my own decision, you know.
McCarr was born in Old Kalinganik in 1955 and moved to Dillingham after the 64 earthquake. He attended boarding school, then the Sheldon Jackson College in Sitka, where he studied land management and religion. He married and started a family in Sitka and worked a variety of jobs, everything from construction to teaching to fishing. But drugs and alcohol took their toll. He spent some time in prison, and in 2002, McCarr moved back to Dillingham. By and large, he's been homeless ever since.
It do involve alcohol, it involved drugs, it involved losing jobs and marriage. So I can't go back to those things every day like I want to, and I have to make that choice for myself.
A number of decisions McCarr chooses not to worry about in advance. Whether he will ask a relative for a place to stay for the night, what he will eat, or when he will look for work.
I learned not to think backwards. That's the most important thing in life. You can't look at yesterday. You can't look at today. But you can't look at tomorrow.
But he will keep making choices to survive, to move when he feels himself freezing, to try to stay off drugs and alcohol, and to play the harmonica to calm his thoughts. And that, it seems, is how he's weathered more than a decade of Alaskan winters outdoors. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
Little lady, I love you with all my heart.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Military historian John Klo has died. First reported by the Alaska Dispatch News, Klo died at his home in Anchorage on December 26th. Klo was born in Virginia, attended the Virginia Military Institute, and later joined the Army. After retiring from a long career as a reservist and Air Force historian, Klo became a guide for Valor Tours. Starting in 2013, he led small groups on World War II tours to Attu. Earlier this fall, Klo published a book on the importance of the little-known Kurile Islands in World War II. In an interview recorded with Klo in November about his book, he said World War II began in the Kuriles and it ended in the Kuriles.
The Japanese used the Southern Kuriles to assemble their carrier task force for the attack on Pearl Harbor. They, you know, gathered them all up together in a big assembly area and slaughtered it all out, and then steamed across the North Pacific over the shipping lanes and bombed Pearl Harbor in December of 1941. The war ended there. Hirohito, the Japanese emperor, announced the surrender of Japan, and all hostilities stopped, except the Russians, about 3 days later, invaded the Kuriles to grab territory. So that was the last battle fought in the North Pacific, was in the Kuril Islands.
John Klo was recently diagnosed with advanced cancer of the lymph nodes. He was 78. Houses can be historic in many senses. For instance, the history that families create. Recently, the owner of one house on a hill in Kodiak found a little of that family history while renovating. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche has more.
I meet Dave Wilmot at the house on a steep side street near McDonald's. He and his girlfriend, Ella, live in the house with Ella's sons, Leo and Zeke, and their cat, Stuart. It's an old cat, the kind of old cat who can't wait for an interview to end before demanding to be let outside, or else.
Hold on, dear buddy. The joys of a 16-year-old cat.
Wilmot says his girlfriend bought the house in 2012, and they began renovation in April 2016. Wilmot, who's a firefighter on the Coast Guard base, says he came home from his shift, and their contractor had left a piece of sheetrock on a workbench. It had been cut from the wall behind a cabinet in the kitchen, and there was a letter on that yellow surface. The words slant down to the left, and although smudged, are still legible. The letter is dated to May 3rd, 1979. Here's an excerpt.
And it says, "Greetings. If you are reading this bit of babble, I would venture to guess you are in the happy state of remodeling this old kitchen.
And that I have long since gone to my maker. My prayers are that you and yours will love this home as it has been loved and lived in. As with all homes, every inch is filled with much love, sweat, and tears. 2 days ago, May 1st, 1979, my life's partner and I celebrated our 25th anniversary. For the first time, we were away from the other on this special day. I have enjoyed 45 years on May 10th of this year."
Those are the words of Phyllis Sundberg, who passed away in 2012, a couple of years after her husband, Gene. But it's the voice of her close friend and neighbor, Ruth Dawson. Dawson was in the kitchen that day in 1979 when the Sundbergs were replacing their cabinets with newer models.
"Phyllis gets out a marker and writes this beautiful story on the wall. She said, oh, won't that be grand someday when new people in the house read this? And I said, oh, we're going to always be here, you know. And she says, no, this will be fun. Well, you know, it was put there and we forgot about it and went on with life.
And just as the letter started with Sundberg, the wall she wrote it on started with her family. Dawson says Sundberg was originally from Idaho and moved to Kodiak when she was a preteen. And her stepfather, Eugene Lightfoot, built the house.
Phyllis's stepdad and her mother lived in the basement when they came here. They lived in the basement while he built the rest of the house. So, you know, that house meant a lot to her. And then she had the road named after him.
Phyllis spent most of her life there, and it's where she raised her three sons with her husband, Gene, who she met in high school. Gene, who was born in Kodiak, held a few jobs throughout his lifetime, including land manager for the Kodiak Regional Corporation and purchasing supervisor for the Kodiak Island Borough School District. Phyllis worked in a bank and was a stay-at-home mom. While their sons have since moved on to other houses, the Sundberg era has had an impact on the community's history. Wilmot found as much when speaking with contractors who might do their home renovation.
I want to say just about every single one had a story about this house. Like they either played with the Sundberg's kids, or they hung out in the neighborhood here. The old city reservoir is just up through the canyon there. And they had swum, you know, gone swimming up there, and they come walking through the yard. So it just, everything reiterated the story of the house.
Wilmot has since framed the sheetrock with a letter and included a plaque with a quote from Charles Dickens. Home is a name, a word. It is a strong one, stronger than magician ever spoke or spirit ever answered to in the strongest conjuration. I'm Kayla DeRoche.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg, Avery Lill in Dillingham, Zoe Sobel in Unalaska, and Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak. Our audio engineer is Ron Zastro. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT now or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline. If you have an opinionated teenager in your home who thrives on proving a point, check out the Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future Scholarship Competition organized by UAA's Seawolf Debate Program. More than $10,000 in prizes will be awarded. Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future gives the next generation of Alaskans a voice in the direction of our state. Contest details available at debatingakfuture.com. This message sponsored by Seawolf Debate.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.